All right, Zig on the Top. Today on the show, we have Bex Marshall. She is a British-based blues guitarist, singer, songwriter. Bex has a new record out. It's called Fortuna. It's available on all streaming platforms. And it's her first record in 10 years. And it slaps. We're going to listen to a tune here. This is Preaching to the Choir off Fortuna, Bex Marshall. Marshall. The album was Fortuna. The tune Preaching to the Choir. It's available now on all streaming platforms. Bex was delightful. This was a really nice conversation. I really dug getting to dive into her career. She also teaches songwriting at songwriting retreats. The North Cyprus Writing Retreat is now available. You can enroll in it if you go to bexmarshall.com. The next available dates are the 10th through the 17th of June 2024. So if you want to learn from the master, you can sign up. I believe it's online as well, and you can do it from anywhere. And if you keep listening, we talk a little bit about songwriting. So that being said, lastly, if you like what you hear, if you can like, rate, review, subscribe to the podcast on any of the podcast platforms, it helps me keep talking to cool guests like Bex and sharing her insight with you. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Bex. Now, to dive into it, the record's awesome. And your playing's fantastic.
Right.
But I kind of wanted to get some background. Now, your grandmother was the original fairground fortune teller. Like,
yes.
What?
I know. My great great grandmother on my mother's side was a lady called Madame Olga, and that, you know, they were travelers. You know, she lived in a barrel top caravan, and she had 13 kids, and one of them was my grandfather, and they kind of ran the fairground down here in Plymouth. And so I had a huge family growing up, you know, the Kiley side. And that was like sort of gypsy tramps and thieves sort of family, you know, but Irish, of Irish descent. And so there's always been that kind of traveling sort of blood in me, which is where I feel comfortable. I feel very at home on the road.
That makes sense. That would make sense. That's fascinating. And I guess on your other side of the family too, there's some of this performative roots, right?
Yeah. Well, my father is actually called Colwell, was called Coleridge, sadly passed away last year. His lineage goes back to Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who was a very famous poet, and then goes back again in history to William the Conqueror. I mean, my father's side was kind of, you know, landed gentry, sort of lords and ladies and all that kind of sort of. So it's like one sort of, you know, completely different than my mother's. So I'm the sort of product of those two, which is quite hilarious, really. But, you know, musically, I definitely pick up from both sides, because obviously the Irish side is very rootsy. And, that's where I think the music side comes. And then my father's side is very lyrical, you know, because my father write songs as well and poems. He was a real character and a storyteller, and that was his thing. He was probably the best storyteller I've ever heard. I mean, he was a comedian and a huge character, real gregarious character, and he was, you know, he made a lot of people laugh in his life. So, you know, I'm very grateful for both of those sort of inputs.
That's incredible. Like, especially to go into songwriting after having roots like that, like as far as like hearing that all the time from your dad, because so much of songwriting is that storytelling. But I want to pick your brain about that in a second. Can you tell me about the 1963 Gibson Hummingbird guitar from your uncle?
Yeah. I played it last night at a gig, yeah? Actually. I don't normally play it. I don't normally take it out, because obviously it's quite a rare and valuable instrument these days. My uncle David, my mother's brother, back in the day, you know, he was a bit of a, he was in the running. I mean, he could have been the next Elvis, or, you know, he was going at the time where, you know, everybody was kind of trying to make their mark on the music scene here. And he was in a band called the Marauders. And so he had the jet black hair, and he had the most incredible voice, very much like Roy Orbison. And he was a great guitarist. He was up there singing and playing just like Elvis, you know. And I remember, you know, him coming down to visit and coming into to my mum's house, and just getting the Gibson out and strumming it and singing. And his voice was so powerful and projected and incredible. It just stunned me. It was like one of those moments where the music hit me, and it hit me for sick. You know, I was like struck deaf, dumb and blind. It was like a scene from Tommy.
Yeah.
You know, and that was where the light bulb came on for me, and I needed to play the guitar. So a couple of years later, he kind of went through this crazy sort of midlife crisis, and came down and gave me the Gibson, thankfully, because God knows where it would have ended up. But, you know, he remained, you know, we remained close throughout my, you know, his life. Sad, he sadly died last year as well. But he was always very, you know, proud of my, you know, me going into the music business full time and stuff. And that guitar now had its third overhaul the other day. I picked it up from the luthiers, and they were like, "Wow, we just don't see them like this anymore." And it's great. It's in great shape. Plays like a dream. It's so peachy, sweet spot. You know all that. I'm just very proud of it, and I realize when I play it, it's the best guitar I own.
Do you remember what song he sang that day?
No, I don't. It's probably one of his.
Yeah.
They did cut a couple of singles back in the day, and he would have probably, he might have been Bye Bye Love or something like that, or, you know, some, I don't know why that song just popped in my head, but I think it probably was Bye Bye Love. Yeah. Now,
did you hear that radio wise or around you before your uncle, or was your uncle kind of like the intro to rock and roll?
You know, where I was born, I'm here now in Plymouth, actually in my dad's house. It was never a music city, this place. So, you know, I wasn't brought up listening to live music. It's not the sort of thing you did really is become a musician from here, back in the day. excuse me. I don't know. It was one of those things that I was just very lucky to be blessed with, a family who had great musical taste. And, you know, I only listened to what was available. There wasn't internet back then. So it's not like I could, you know, I had the tools to sort of go out and find stuff. It was just whatever was brought in front of me. And so, you know, it was, I picked up on it early, and I pushed forward, and I stamped my feet until I got a guitar, and I was about 9.
What a cool, like, I don't know, that's so special, though, to be able to carry like that with you, that, you know, and knowing how like proud of your uncle, or proud your uncle was of you, and like to be able to still like have that guitar playable, and like still be able to like, you know, celebrate his, yeah, his legacy through yours. That's so cool. Like, there's,
yeah,
some...
I mean, he used to keep tabs on me, and, you know, but he played up until his late 70s. I mean, and he was still going around old folks' homes playing, and his voice was still strong at that age. So his passion, you know, went right the way through his life too. But he would always say about, you know, all his guitars, I've got this now, and I've got this and that. And I go, yeah, but none of them are as good as the one you gave me. And he goes, no, that's true.
One thing I'd be interested, like, kind of with like Scottish roots, do you see like a similarity with blues music?
You know, it's funny because, like, every time I think about, you know, influences and stuff like that, I think it, you know, as I've gone through life, I'm constantly influenced. And, you know, it dawned on me probably, you know, sort of my late teens. I mean, I like stuff, but I didn't really think about why I liked it. You know, I just naturally gravitated towards it. You know, and when I, you know, everything I've done, which has exposed me to anything bluesy or rootsy through my life, I've latched onto and sort of, I've taken a little from a lot, you know, and it snowballs and eventually into your own, you know, spider's web.
Right. Well, of course, we're all like a product of what we grow up with, and like what we're exposed to and what we're inspired by. I guess with that, I meant like specifically like within the plane of like the Scottish like folk music. Is there an overlap of like chord progression, song formation, lyric couplets?
Well, it's actually Irish, not Scottish.
I'm sorry.
Although I am a Scotland in a few weeks' time. Irish, yeah, definitely. If you look back into some of my my albums, there's little Irish licks that, you know, sort of like diddly dee licks that I sort of throw in, like, you know, that's at the end of one of my songs on the Kitchen Table album called Red Light. And I don't know, you know, I mean, yeah. When I kind of realised I had obviously I knew, you know, my connections with Ireland, but I'd never been. And I decided one year that I was, you know, I sort of bugged my dad and, come on, we're going to go to Ireland and find our roots sort of thing. And, you know, we did several trips driving around Ireland and, you know, hitting the bars and, you know, I was trying to get gigs there and I was getting gigs and then I was so, like, drawn. I was flying back once a month just to do these gigs just so I could get back there and indulge in it, you know. And, yeah, I certainly sort of, you know, dug in and I ended up playing at the Clonakilty Guitar Festival, which was fantastic. I'm very much drawn to Ireland, so much so I'm kind of thinking about buying a place there, you know, sometime in the future. I love everything about Ireland, and I've got getting my Irish passport soon as well, so it's going to be a big thing, you know, to be a citizen of Ireland. And I taken this long to sort it out, but obviously with the EU as well, it's in my benefit. It's a thing that, you know, it makes sense for me to do. But also, I think it's going to draw me much closer back to my roots.
That's beautiful. And I guess the one thing I kind of noticed with, I guess, the crossover of Irish guitar and blues, there's that kind of 6/8 feel. Like that lick you're describing, there's that kind of that triplety thing. And also, like, I've seen, and I don't know, I've only seen a few, but kind of like Celtic guitarist where it's in open tunings, that it's kind of like similar to like slide playing open tunings.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's great to be able to include those kind of influences and those guitar. I mean, on my House of Mercy album, I have a fabulous musician called Eileen Healy, a violin player, fiddle player from Cork. She hosts and runs a lot of the top sessions in Cork, you know, the acoustic sessions. And they're just magical. You know, you go in and everything's silent and, you know, the band are playing and it's all very acoustic and super, you know, vibey. And so, you know, I've soaked up those sessions and I really love that style of playing, you know, the roots instruments and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's like subconsciously soaks in and, you know, House of Mercy record is definitely a lot of that going through it, as well as the bluegrass element as well from the Reno Brothers that play on that record too.
That's so cool to be like, I guess that's the with blues and in the kind of like general context, that's what's so cool about it is the 1/4/5, you can put just about anything kind of over it because of how it works. And like that's super cool to be able to throw all those influences in it and be able to have like other people bring out things you wouldn't have been like, you wouldn't have thought of yourself.
Absolutely.
I guess one thing I found really interesting, you brought up the Kitchen Table the Kitchen Table album, and then on this record, there's a Table Alone. Table seems to be like a metaphor for you. Do you find a lot of like meaning from the table?
Well, I think it's certainly a place where things start and finish. You know, meals, conversations, meetings, you know, drinks, food. It's just like, it's a place where anything can happen. And and so, yeah, things do happen around the table. The Table for One, actually, yeah. It's that was an interesting moment, sitting alone eating a meal, quite happy, but, you know, just noticing the reactions of people in the restaurant because I was sat alone. So that's where that came from. But, yeah, The Kitchen Table is obviously – everyone could write that song, you know, with things that happen to them around the kitchen table. That's always a fun element to when I play it live, you know. I always start it off, you know, as, okay, has anybody had sex on the kitchen table lately? So that always gets their attention.
The kind of take that you run songwriting seminars retreats.
Retreats.
So, and like the kitchen table is such like, or just a table, right? Is such like, that can be so many things as far as like a songwriting exercise or like narration. Yeah. Like now, yeah. I guess as far as like your songwriting, do you have like a practice that you do? Are you a lyric person? Is it inspiration?
Well, again, you know, it's like, I don't stick. The only rules are the ones you stick by, and I hate to put rules around a creative sort of moment. And I used to think to myself, "What do I do?" I mean, you know, because I never think about those sort of things until I sort of think about them, and I think, well, okay, I always had to clean the house or clean the room I was doing it in first. I always had to make sure it was super tidy before I would sit down. I don't know, sort of to focus on. This sort of, you know, moment has to be kind of, for me, you know, the house needed to be tidy. And that's why, and I would do it and I'd be going, I just want to sit down and play. Why am I tidying up? You know what I mean? It's like a weird thing that you do. But, and then I'd sit and then I would just, you know, go through my poems because I'm always writing poems if I'm sat on a plane or train or middle of the night or something comes in my head, and that moment when it comes in your head, you need to put it down because you will forget it, you know. So if you're kind of, you're rhyming a couple of lines that are really cool lines, just you know, write them down and then go back to them and include them or work on them later. That's what I do. And then every now and again, I look through all my notes and there's a whole bunch of, you know, songs in different stages or poems in different stages. And if I have a session, I'll sit down and it's like looking through a wardrobe. I'll think, I'll wear that one or something, you know. And then you bring it out and then you got to go and iron it. And that's the kind of process I go through, like, you know. And eventually they'll craft themselves into something that is, you know, it gets its own identity and then you can start practicing it. You know, and they're all in different sort of stages of creation, really. And then if we do like a session, you know, it's all about sort of when something jumps out and inspires you, and, you know, to work on it, and different, you know, to go back and hone it and to rehash it and stuff is a good thing because, you know, you keep the cherries and then you add more cherries. You know, and then eventually you think, now that's ready to present to the band or start building up to jam it. You know, and then you try and get a couple of hooks in there and get things working and a chorus or whatever. And, you know, it's like building a Christmas tree, you know. Does it need that extra bit of tinsel? Maybe not. But you've got to feel your way. It's just like, you know, it's using all your natural kind of instincts to when you feel it's right.
I think those are wise words indeed. Cause like, yeah. You know, I've talked with some people and they do every day or some people that only take when the moment's there, but like your process, it sounds like the most, as far as for me, like I relate to that a lot. Cause that's kind of how, what I find myself doing, like finding the thing, jotting it down, like having it or doing the phone recording, having that bit, and then like, sweet, I'll come back to that or the next thing happens and you have to go to the gig or you have to do this or you're stuck there all night. And like, so to be able to come back and kind of like cherry picked through it.
Well, it's organic. And it doesn't put yourself, as soon as you start putting yourself under pressure to create, it's over. You know, because creation is all about trying and playing around and playtime. And when you've got, you know, confinements, you can't play, you can't try things, because trying things isn't wrong. It's never wrong. You know, there are no rules. You try it until you feel it works. And that's you, you know, that's your style. That's your, you as an artist deciding that.
Yeah. Yeah. One, I guess, on the opposite of, like, songwriting lyrically, well, you know, actually, like, hearing stories from your dad, that kind of, like, and you said he wrote songs and wrote poetry, right? Did you kind of see his, how he would do it? Like, yeah. Is that similar to how you do?
Kind of, yeah. He was like a comedy writer, you know. Most of his poems were funny. But it doesn't really matter, you know. I mean, yeah. He did definitely had his own little style. He was really good, actually. He'd write in a sort of predictable kind of American sort of comedy tunes and stuff like that. He wouldn't write love songs and things, or, you know, but it would be like, you know, sort of slapstick style he would write, like vaudeville-y kind of thing. But his lyrics were funny and they were very clever, you know, you'd be bursting out laughing, you know, and he could nail it. Yeah, he was a great poet, my dad.
And I think there's like a certain comfort behind comedy too. You know what I mean? Like, I think if you're being comedic, it's easier to, like, it's a different type of vulnerability, I think. Like, where it's like, of course it's supposed to be da-doy. It didn't land, but, or, you know, it landed and it was slapstick, but that was the point. Like,
exactly. Yeah. And he definitely gave me my humor. He couldn't have a serious conversation with my dad. For my whole life, I've never had a serious conversation with him. And, you know, I took him on tour. He was very positive all the time. You know, he loved to drink and, you know, he was very proud of me. So, you know, when things started picking up and I was touring and I go, "Come on, Dad, well, you know, we're going to go to America." And he'd be like, "Oh, yeah, right." You know, there was no, "Oh, I can't do that." You know, he would be like, "Yeah, come on, let's go." You know, I'd be like, "Yeah, come on then." And we'd have a laugh, you know, and, you know, I took him to a lot of places: America, Ireland, Holland, you know, Cyprus, you know, all around the UK, the Orkney Islands with the Proclaimers. I mean, you know, he's had some great times on the road with me. And the great thing about that is when you come home and at some point in the future, you hear, I would hear him sort of relaying that story, and, you know, it would be completely different from my recollection, because, you know, I only sort of soak up so much because it's my, you know, I'm the performer, I'm kind of thinking professional, you know, is my sound all right, is my guitar, strings, you know, all that. And he's kind of looking at it, is it, I'm on a jolly, you know. And, you know, I'd get off stage many times and he'd be at the bar, at the end of the bar, absolutely hammered. You know, and giving all my CDs away to all his new friends. That, you know, that was my dad, and everyone loved him, and everyone always asked after him, you know, when I'd go back there. So it's very important, I think, to share your music, what it affords you to do, you know, to be able to travel and see the world and take your music. You know, doing it on your own is great and it's wonderful, it's living the dream. But to share it with your loved ones is something that, you know, is priceless. And, you know, it always gave me really great feeling, you know, when he would relay the stories of us being on the road.
That's so special. That's so cool. Like, to be able to, and like, I totally understand when you're there, you're like, "Oh, this is, I got to make sure this works. This is, they're coming in. Is it a good night? Are the promoters happy? Whatever." You know what I mean? There's so many things going through your head that that it's good that there's someone who's like bringing the fun and just getting to celebrate that with you. That's so cool.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
I guess where I wanted to go before was with like, so I've also noticed on with every record I was able to get of yours that there's a at least like an instrumental track, and and I'm like, that's very Freddie King, like that's very cool that that's kind of given its space. And with the new record Fortuna and the head track being the instrumental, like is Freddie King kind of an influence in that sense? Are you like, do you write instrumentals differently?
Absolutely, Freddie King is an influence. Yeah, but I mean, it's not just Freddie King. I mean, there's so many outstanding instrumentals that I absolutely love. You know, and I'm a, you know, I started learning guitar. You know, and it was instrumentals I was playing. You know, the first thing that I was officially taught was finger picking style instrumentals.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you can sort of nail that style and play a beautiful piece of music, it's jaw-dropping. It can be jaw-dropping, you know. I mean, things like Albatross, you know, or dueling banjos, you know, they're all great instrumentals and they're all brilliant, you know, pieces of music that you can recognize instantly from their melody lines, their strong melody lines. And, you know, they evoke as much emotion, I think, as lyrics. So, yeah.
Do you often find yourself coming up with melody lines based around like an instrumental, like kind of coming up with a melody line on the guitar, or and then basing the what you would sing kind of around that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as I say, you know, like that track on the new album, When It's Gone, that was an instrumental for a long, long time. And then eventually I wrote the lyrics, I pieced the lyrics together. And I thought, yeah, that works now. I mean, it was going to be an instrumental. Oh, I mean, I could play it as an instrumental and it holds up. I think it really works now with that lyrical sort of content on it. I'd like to be able to play the song, and it needs to be a strong melody line, you know, for me anyway, you know, a nice hook, a nice hooks and stuff, in most of my stuff. I think instrumentals are very important and they shouldn't be overlooked. And, you know, it's a lot of fun to write an instrumental. I mean, and also, you know, the parts of the instrumental take you on a journey on their own, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting that When It's Gone was started off that way. That song really stuck out to me when I went through the record. So I usually go through it a few times before reading anything about the person I'm going to talk to.
Okay.
And that song in particular, especially like the chorus, is such a unique track compared to the rest of the tracks on this record. And it, like, for you, do you find that with that tune in particular? Is it because it kind of came from this instrumental writing process?
Yeah, quite possibly. And also a lot of people just go, like, they really love it. You know, it's one that's mentioned a lot. And I'm really happy with it, yeah. Yeah, it's quite a different sort of craft, like the way I crafted it. It's like two parts. It just rolls around two parts. But it's kind of flows nicely, I think, that melody flows, and it's just the two sort of parts, and it just back and forth, it goes back and forth and back and forth, and you could play it forever. It's one of those, you think, it's like one of those optical illusions that just kind of rolls into itself all the time, you know. And I thought, well, if I put a nice strong vocal over the top in a higher register, because I don't do too much now. You know, a lot of my stuff, because they're stories, I don't want to be blasting it out so people can't understand what I'm saying. You know, the the diction needs to be there, the pronunciation. And so that's why I sort of bring it down to a lower register to enunciate the words correctly. So, you know, people can follow the story. But that one, it reminds me of Maggie May. You know, that was one of my old favorite songs from years ago where, you know, wake up, Maggie, I think I, you know, it's one of those sort of, you know, bleating sort of, you know, blaring lyrics, which, you know, I'm singing joyfully, but the sentiment's actually quite poignant. And so, yeah, there's a lot of sort of things going on in that one.
Yeah, it's a beautiful tune. That's an interesting process to kind of come to is knowing when to dial back the performance so the message of the song can be kind of clearer.
Right.
Now, with like some of these other tunes, did you find that you had to kind of dial back performance too, or kind of enhance like that? That I guess when, aside from like when would the opposite happen for you? I think like preaching for the choir, there's enough space in that song to really like kind of belt it like you do and kind of like hear that narrative. And same with like Dirty Water. I feel like the narrative's heard and it's kind of got that oomph to it. But yeah. Was that like a choice or was that something that kind of just felt right?
Well, you know, preaching to the choir's got the element, the gospel element in it, and you know, certain things come through on certain songs that are required, you know,
right.
And you don't over egg the pudding with everything, you know. And I think with a studio album, you have that luxury of being able to, you know, either push a lyric forward or push a little riff forward to make that song memorable, you know. And there's always some element that makes a song, you know, hooky or whatever, that you would remember. And, you know, Preacher to the Choir is actually, the main single of the album in my world, in my head about that. I was like, yeah, this one's the one this is the single that will push forward on the record. That's why it's on the front. It's, you know, when I get in the car and it comes on as the first single of the record, it feels good. You know, it feels like a nice door opening, like a strong single to me. And it's kind of, you know, it's produced. There's a lot of stuff going on. It's a nice presentation, really, of, I guess, me all round, songwriting, vocal and guitar. And, you know, the message is kind of poignant as well for today. I think people are just a bit miffed and peed off with everything that, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's
being told this and being told that. it was kind of where I am at the moment, where I feel like after the lockdown, that's my sort of gut instinct as well. So yeah, and it's really about really what the song needs. I mean, I'm a bit of a stickler for that, you know. Whatever the story is, the vocal needs to be up. You need to be able to hear the lyrics and the words because they make you feel what you feel when you listen to a track.
Right. Was it? As far as like the lockdown, what did you do? As far as like, I found myself really having to dive into a routine. Like I had to make like, okay, for this hour, I'm going to practice this, learn this picking technique or practice to write. I'm going to write or whatever. I had to do that to get through that.
Yeah. Well, I think once the novelty had worn off for everybody and, you know, getting drunk every night for the first sort of 6 weeks, and then we were like, well, what are we going to do then? For us, you know, we were in London. There was four of us in the house. You know, in my head, I was like, well, this is a good time to create, write, piece together the album, demo, concentrate. You know, I had my bass player locked down with us. And that goes off on a tangent story because he actually died in our house several months into the lockdown, yeah. But before that happened, we made a TV show. Well, not a TV show, but a little sort of online show once a week, which was something that we really looked forward to. Producing. My partner is a fine dining chef. And then there was myself and Robert Red Daniels, who's an amazing six-string bass player. So between the three of us, we created a sort of one-hour segment, including obviously performance, food. We do a live cooking segment. And then during the lockdown, we actually built a sort of a bistro bar in the back garden so we could actually get dressed up and go to the pub. And so our neighbour, you know, cut a hole in the fence and put a drop-down mirrored sort of, you know, bar thing on chains so he could have a drink with us in his garden. So we had our little bubble going on. And once a week we go live for an hour, and it was called Love in Lockdown. And, I do all the graphics and stuff. And we called the bar was called the Dodgy Fox. Because we had so many foxes appear because nobody, you know, there was nobody on the roads and the wildlife was taking back London. So we had all these foxes jumping over the gardens and ripping the hell out of the gardens. So we called it the Dodgy Fox. Oh, one of the foxes went under my neighbor's shed and had babies. So we had all baby foxes running around. And, of course, that's where it was born. So we would and they're online. There's a few of them online. And of course you had the technical problems of feedback. Well, the other segment of the bar, show was I would contact one of the characters that I'd met on my years of touring and invite them to be, a guest at the segment called Character at the Cocktail Bar. So they would be lined up ready for me to run in and I'd make a cocktail at the Dodgy Fox Bar while they were making their cocktail somewhere around the world, and we'd be discussing what the hell's going on, how are you dealing with lockdown, blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
And usually the person had, you know, a record or a book or was telling, you know, them about what they were doing and stuff as well. So they were creatives. And so so there'd be like a 3-song performance, then like a 20-minute segment of Jonathan chopping up things and cooking it, then a character at the cocktail bar with a quick beer. And then back in the studio to finish off with another 3 songs. And then the last bit, you'd see Jonathan coming out with the delicious finished product of what he'd cooked and putting it in front of us. And us eating it going, have a great week. You know, so it was called Love in Lockdown, basically.
That's amazing. That's such a cool, like, what a way for everyone to get involved and kind of get the broader internet community that you've already kind of developed involved and have something to do. That's really cool.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, because it felt like a live show. Well, it was a live show for us, but it was also, you know, a chance for people to kind of log on and see what we were up to and communicate properly, you know, and that whole sort of live feeling for an hour was quite, you know, it was warts and all, you know.
That's incredible. Well, Bex, I came up with that schedule, right, and I had that routine going, and I found myself streaming a lot for the venues, the local venues. Mm. They'd bring a band in, and we would do like a benefit stream, and I like that was kind of where 2020 went for me and my group, is we helped out a lot and did a lot of fundraising and stuff like that. But a live TV show like that would have been way more fun.
Well, you know, I mean, we were still creating. Yeah. And it was great because Jonathan would be thinking like, what am I going to cook this week? And, you know, and it was always something spectacular. And, you know, so that there was that. I mean, cooking is like massive. Everybody loves to see someone cooking something. And then we'd be there at the end eating it going, oh, my God, it's gorgeous, you know. And everybody, you know, it's just like addictive viewing. It was good.
Bex, I really appreciate your time and your flexibility. I know this has been a pleasure to dive into your career and have this conversation. Before we go, I have one more question. You toured with Big Brother in the Holding Company as filling in for Janice. How'd that come about, and like, how was that?
Well, my agent, well, one of my agents in the UK, he regularly used to bring over the sort of, you know, the vintage Woodstock era artists from San Francisco to tour in the UK. And he was actually asked by Sam Andrews from Big Brother, we need a British Janice for when we come over. And JR, his name was, said, well, there's only one person that can do that, and bless him. And I got the call, and luckily got the job, and went out on the road with the San Francisco Knights when they came over. And that was that included Greg Douglas from Steve Miller Band, who's phenomenal. Yeah. We went out and toured, and I just thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it or what, you know, it's a lot of belting every night. But, you know, my voice actually got stronger after 4 or 5 days. I was really nailing it, and I just thought, I couldn't believe it. It was brilliant, and it opened up a huge, you know, opportunities for me in America. And I was invited over to stay with a good friend of mine called Crowbar. Somebody said, you speak so affectionately about a guy called Crowbar. But no, it's... he's like this fantastic old original hippie from San Francisco who puts on these parties every year called the Artista parties, and they always involve like original members of Woodstock and stuff like that. And it, you know, it's one of those sort of gangs where you get the jacket and everything, you know, it's really cool. And he invited me over, and when I got there, he'd actually built me my own bedroom in his garden, which is like a little log cabin. He'd gone and bought a kind of a whole, you know, flat pack Swedish cabin and built me my own bedroom. And it's now named Bex's room. And so every time I hit California or Petaluma, up in San Francisco, it's my room. And I've stayed there many times with him now. We're good friends. So, yeah, I mean, it was great and a huge honor. And I learned an awful lot from those guys. And Sam, you know, was a lovely guy. Sadly, you know, he died several months later. But he did say to me, I gave Janice the first job and you the last.
Damn. Yeah. Wow. Oh, my gosh. That, what an honor. Jeez.
Yeah, it was great.
As far as, like, I guess prepping your voice for that, if you don't mind me kind of picking into that, was it like, I mean, you have that, like, in you already. Was it just kind of honing that and like, or what did that, was it like breathing? What did that look like?
No, well, you know, to be honest, I think, you know, all my life since I realized I had a voice, or, you know, I could hold a note, I've always been able to sort of mimic people. And I think when karaoke came out and everybody was trying to sing their favorite artists, you know, I mean, I was no different really, but I could sort of nail it. And I've always sang, you know, I've got that kind of sort of voice, and I can bend it, you know, from country to jazz to blues to rock, to old style, you know, back porchy kind of, you know. And so, but, you know, I want, obviously, got to find my own voice after years of influence of all those great singers. I feel like I'm settled in my voice now. But years ago, you know, I'd be trying to, you know, mimic people from, you know, Tina Turner to Cher to, you know, Rod Stewart to Axl Rose, you know, AC/DC. And I could do them all, you know, in those sort of tones. And so Janice was, yeah, obviously, something that I had to sort of just focus and listen and soak it up, soak up her persona. But when I got on stage, all I really wanted to do was to deliver the performance like she was alive. So I didn't want to do it sort of note for note, like it was recorded, So it would have been like a, you know, every little nuance. I wanted to do it like she was in me from somewhere else, portraying it and delivering it. Like if she would have been alive now, she may have ad-libbed like that or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And
so I wanted a real life performance, you know. And I think I delivered that to a degree. And, you know, I'm very much a spur of the moment sort of gut instinct performer anyway. And I cannot stick to a set list.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. I know I don't do it for myself, and my band hate me.
Was it? I relate to that. I relate to that. You never know who's gonna react to what, and you're like, "We're killing it with this. Let's keep this going." Like I get that. That, but that also keeps it fresh for you and for everyone involved.
Yes, and it keeps people on their toes, and it keeps the adrenaline high, and it keeps you on the edge. And you know, if you can nail it. I mean, at the end of my last American tour as a three-piece, we were so tight. And it was like sort of super high-energy training every night, like you were in the gym. And by the end of 6 weeks, we were so ripped. You know, I'd get on stage and they never knew what I was going to start with. And I'd just have to play a couple of sort of notes and boom, you know, everyone was in. And everyone's tight, and yeah, it was a phenomenal feeling to be that tight with your band. And I can't do predictability. So, you know, once you start being predictable, you lose that kind of passion. You lose that fly by the seat of your pants kind of feeling. Which I think once you got that on stage, people are just mesmerized because you're like. You know, your frequency is so high because you're enjoying it so much and you're radiating that energy. That's what makes a great show, you know.
Definitely wise advice there. Bex?
It's the best drug in the world.
Yeah. Well, when you see that and you're drawn to that, you feel, you know, as a viewer, you feel that like – that excitement, right? And as a performer, you know, it's like next level.
Yeah, that's it. And people connect with you when you're feeling like that and they pick it up and then they start feeding off it. I mean, that's when, you know, I come off stage after a performance, which has been electrifying and absolutely bang on. And you come up and people are sort of reeling from that performance you've given them, you've connected with them, you've actually plugged into them, you know. And so that's when they come up after the show and they're gushing and they're alive and they're, as you know, they've, it's kind of like, and it's just, you know, it's nothing like live, you know, performance. And that, and I've started wearing these sort of mini, you know, sunglasses that take video of people's expressions and their reactions when I come off stage, because they're priceless.
That's amazing. I've definitely been the gushy, like, oh my god, that was so amazing. You know, I think we all have been that. I think you got to be that before you can like do it. You know what I mean? To appreciate someone, that connection with somebody. You know,
I think for me, that is the reason I do what I do, is to be able to. So you be able to gift someone, a complete stranger, that euphoria, you know. I mean, you know, yes, it's healing and all that, and it's, you know, but it's something that it's so precious, you know. There's no negativity about it. You can do it like time and time and time again, and it's, you know, it's the best thing, I think. To be able to give someone a feeling and a musical presentation that affects them like that and makes them joyous, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Bex, I really appreciate your time and your flexibility with everything.
No problem.
Thank you. Is there something that we didn't get to cover that you want to plug before that I might have missed?
You know, if anyone's interested in coming to our writing retreats in Cyprus, they should just hit bexmarshall.com and go to the Cyprus writing retreat page, because, you know, it is a thing that people can come on from all over the world. And I have, you know, special guests. We've got Nick Moss from Chicago. We've got a Mike Ross in the UK, and you've got a Nick Moss. Nick Moss. I mix them up all the time. But no, it's Nick Moss who's coming from Chicago in May. And Greg Douglas from the Steve Miller Band's coming in October.
Oh, wow.
So if anybody fancies a week with a proper rock star, and me, and Jonathan, fine dining chef, and a whole bunch of other amazing players in North Cyprus, then to reach out and give us a message. And, because it's what it's all about. It's creating new music for us.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome, Bex. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, like I was saying, and the flex. This has been a wild couple days here, but I've really much enjoyed diving into your career and your music, and this was a very nice conversation, so thank you.
You're welcome, and lovely to speak to you too. Let's keep in touch.
Awesome. Yeah, let me know when you...
Yo, Spike Spiegel here. You just listened to Zig of the Gig podcast. Keep riding the bebop. See you, Space Cowboy. Bang.